If you're wondering what is going on in coffee business in Brazil, please follow me.
Your podcast with a little bit of Brazilian coffee. Café.
Hello, my name is Kelly Stein. I'm a journalist who loves coffee. I'm writing about this subject for 7 years, and now this is Coffee, the podcast where you can find any sort of information about coffee. If you're interested about farming or just consuming and roasting, just ignore my weird accent and focus in the information. To start the English edition of Coffee, I have a very special guest, Byron Holcomb. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, Byron Holcomb.
He is here to talk about very special work he's doing in verticalization in the coffee business. Welcome, Byron.
Thank you, Kelly. It's exciting to be here. My current job title is the Director of Agribusiness. I work for FAL Holdings Participações Limitada, which is a company that owns 2 coffee farms here in Brazil. And we kind of form what we call the base of the triangle. And so our coffee is produced on these 2 farms. Also have 2 trading offices and warehouses that we also have roasting in New York City. And we're soon to have 2, possibly 3 retail locations in New York City. And so the idea being the production here in Brazil gets all the way to the end consumer in the cup within the same family of businesses. So that's what we would define as kind of vertical integration. And my job is the day-to-day management of the farms. Every day is different. And so sometimes I'm up always very early because that's when you can get the most done with the staff on the farms. But sometimes we're looking at the weeds. Sometimes we're looking at the coffee. Sometimes it's processing during harvest. It's always pretty intense because there's rains that can come through. Anything can change at any moment. Sometimes it's processing during harvest. It's always pretty intense because there's rains that can come through. Anything can change at any moment. It's been a ride.
Every day, the world consumes 300 tons of caffeine, enough for 1 cup of coffee for every man, woman, and child. The world's largest buyer of coffee, the U.S., has to import nearly all of this, as the coffee trees from which caffeine is harvested will only grow at commercial levels between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn in an area called the Coffee Belt. Only a single state, Hawaii, is within this belt. However, the United States is only the largest buyer because it's so populous. The most enthusiastic coffee drinkers per capita are, in increasing order, the Netherlands, Denmark, Iceland, Norway, and, the world champions, Finland, where they drink 3 times as much coffee a day as the average American. All of these countries are outside the coffee belt and must import 100% of their caffeine supply.
Let's start from the beginning, because when I heard that a foreigner just exchanged his nice life in America to come to a countryside in Minas Gerais here in Brazil, it sounded weird. But your story of Brazil started years ago, right?
Yeah, I guess my story in coffee started in 2003, technically, when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Dominican Republic. I worked for coffee farmers there for 2 years. When I went back to the United States in 2005, kind of worked my way through the industry a little bit in roasting. I was a barista at one point, became a coffee buyer. And when I was a coffee buyer, I worked for Dallas Brothers Coffee. And Dallas Brothers Coffee was actually a roasting branch of a coffee farm here in Brazil, in Pedregulho, São Paulo. And so every year I would come to Pedregulho and see the farm that was kind of a sister company to us. I learned a little bit about what life was like here, but had no idea that someday I would end up moving here.
When you started working at Dallas Brothers, how long did you take the decision and come over? How many years?
Well, you know, I'd been at Dallas Brothers for about 3 years, and it was a great experience. You know, really great coffees, really exciting concept. When the opportunity came my way, there was pretty much no delay. I immediately decided that if I could move to Brazil to run basically a similar operation from the farm side, that I could really add some value. Because as much as we like to think in the roasting side that we get to create flavors, for the most part, we're maintaining the flavor that already existed in the coffee. And when you're on the farm side, the sky's the limit, as you could say, in terms of potential for both creating great working conditions, but also creating great coffee.
Fall Coffee didn't start with the farms, right? How did it start?
Actually, it did. The first company that was started was the farm.
The coffee farm?
Yeah. So they purchased the FAL Group came here and purchased the farm from Marco Suplicy, Santa Isabel. And they were really excited about the concept. And then they met one of the ex-CEO. He used to be the CEO, named John Moore in New York City, and he had these really strong relations with the New York coffee community, and he was the one who kind of spearheaded some of the roasting and retail.
And it's really interesting because controlling the whole steps of coffee production can be really tricky. And Marco Suplicy, he started here in Brazil, but it didn't work out properly, right? So that's why he sold his farm.
Correct. Yeah, it's really difficult, and it's still difficult.
It can be interesting when you think one company decide to invest loads of money to control the whole producing from another company that tried that but didn't work out. So it's courageous.
It is courageous.
What are the ingredients to successfully create a vertically integrated supply chain?
Great question. Like we were saying, you know, possibly it did not work out for Marco Suplicy. I think one of the challenges with vertical integration is you have to have really talented coffee people in every sector managing every sector. And so one of the big challenges that if somebody wanted to have a vertically integrated coffee supply chain, you would have to have a few different things. Number one, you'd have to have a visionary. You'd have to have a visionary who understood that from the farm all the way through to the cup, there is a lot of risk, but then in that same moment, there's also a lot of opportunity. You'd also have to have some resources. And so, as you said, it is an expensive endeavor. It does take resources, and that's just the reality of it. Especially when you're starting over a period of about 3 years, going from no farms to having two farms, two mills, roasting in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and then some retail stores.
How many people are involved? Employees?
In the whole?
From soil to sip?
From soil to sip, I would say we probably have over 200.
So there are lots and lots of people to qualify.
Yeah, there's a couple different ways to look at it. When we purchased the farms, the staff that were working on the farm stayed on the farm. When we purchased the mills, same thing. A lot of the staff have stayed and worked with us still today. And so all of that knowledge we've been able to keep in the company, which has been really important, because knowing how a drier harvest can kind of behave really gives us a lot of information as to how we can better make decisions on the ground while things are happening. In New York, we're starting from scratch. We started with a kind of a warehouse in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and installing two roasters. The World Trade Center store didn't exist when we started, and it is soon to be open. And so it's a lot of kind of ground up initiative. But I think probably as important as having the resources is you have to have that visionary person who's going to see the whole chain and understand that in 1 year, for example, you could have an extremely expensive coffee market. So the coffee market can go way up or go way down. When that coffee market goes way up, it's better for the farms. But your roasting operation could probably suffer because you're paying more for the same raw product. And so by being able to have a position in the entire chain, you've essentially equalized actually a lot of the risk you're exposed to.
Diversification. What I've learned that works if you're an investor, no matter how much money you've got, whether it's $5,000 or $500 million, diversification is what saves you from disaster. Having investments in a wide range of businesses and sectors, there's always something working when something else isn't.
When you control the whole chain, you also have another opportunity to multiply your customers. For example, I don't know any farm that produces 100% specialty.
Mm-hmm.
So farms can produce commodity, low quality, and very good quality. So in your example, you have all sort of clients, right?
Also.
How does it work?
So in every sector, it's different. So I always talk about the coffee farm being, to a certain extent, it's a bit like a butcher in the sense that we spend all year long to produce coffee. But it doesn't mean all the coffee we produce is filet mignon.
You know, exactly. Great analogy.
when you harvest a cow, you get two filet mignon, but you also get two ears, you get four legs,
yeah.
You get the hooves and lots of bones. And so that all has a home. You know, all the underripes and the overripe coffee and some of the grinders and the bits and the little defects that come out of our great coffee. To make our great coffee great, all of that goes somewhere.
And the key is find someone qualified to sell the filet mignon, but also the bones and the ears and the tail.
Exactly. And I think that's where having the visionary, and that would be the third ingredient, having your visionary who understands equalization of risk that can occur with a vertical integrated system, as well as the resources, as well as having that know-how is probably one of the most limited resources that I think you can find in coffee, in the sense that as opposed to getting specialists, super, super specialists, where you'd have to have 10 or 15 in the entire chain, you're having to find a few people that are very well cross-trained. And so I think that's kind of where my skill set comes into play as someone who understands a little bit of the end of the chain, understands a fair amount about production, processing, even selling some of the better coffees. So when I go to sell the ears and feet and tail of our coffee harvest, I turn to our warehouse manager, Umberto Filio, and that's his specialty. And so when I turn to him and say, hey, I have this coffee, it's underripe and really not that delicious, will you help me sell it? He knows exactly where that coffee should
and
go
and how to get the best prices.
Exactly. And so you have to have that know-how inside your company. And that's why if you're going to do something that's vertically integrated in coffee, it'd be really difficult if it was extremely small, because you have to have a certain level of volume to be able to run a professional level business.
How long are you in Brazil already?
So I've been here for about 3.5 years. I got the job offer in March of 2013. We moved in May, and so there was almost no time to learn Portuguese. And so I kind of got here and used my Spanish to get by for the first several months.
And how was this road? You arrived, it was boiling hot.
Well, thankfully I arrived in May, and so it was only hot during the day. And then it was really cold at night. We actually were colder here than we are in New York. In home, during the winter in New York, it's very hot in the apartment. But during the winter here in Brazil, which is the opposite season of New York, it's really cold at home. And so we ended up having to go to the Borda da Mata, which is the pajama capital of Brazil, which is next to us, and buy onesie fleeces so we can stay warm. Because it's really cold at night on the farm.
If you never came to Brazil, let me explain. Here, culturally, we don't have isolation.
No.
That's insulation. Why it's so cold.
Yeah.
I have lots of foreigner friends who come over and say, it's colder here than my house.
Yeah.
How is it possible? It's Brazil.
Yeah.
I didn't pay for this.
No. And it's tough because when we moved here, we actually lived on the farm. So my wife, Laura, and I moved onto the farm, and there were, at, you know, over 1,000 meters, and it was really cold. We actually had frost. I light frost a couple times. The temperature was pretty easy to adjust to once we got our onesie fleeces. You know, culturally, that takes time to adjust, I think.
Especially when you have to manage how many employees in the farms.
So when we got here, we only had Fazenda Santa Isabel, which had about, I think when we got here, it had about 20 staff.
And you didn't know lots of Portuguese?
No.
Tell me about it.
It was difficult. Thankfully, the manager there was really, really good at understanding my portuñol.
Okay.
And to this day, there are people on the farm that I don't understand. I mean, they're...
Until today?
No, there's a couple guys on the staff that their accent is so mineiro and so caipira that I still like call in or like someone else. I'm like, will you help us have a conversation? Because I need an interpreter.
It's important to mention that in the countryside, people don't speak Portuguese properly. That's why maybe you don't understand because they have less education than in the cities.
Oh yeah.
And they have lots of accent.
The accent is what got me. There were many times when I first got here that I would write something as people would say it, and Google Translate or Google Correct would say that I was wrong, and I was like, no. This is how you say it. And then I realized that we were switching R's and L's like placa and praca. and it took me a while to realize I was learning a pretty heavy mineiro accent. And I still have one, but now people understand me pretty well.
Good. Tell me about the bureaucracy when you arrived.
I think that's probably the biggest challenge that we didn't expect. You know, we understood that, you know, labor laws are complicated in Brazil, that it's going to be a new accounting system, and that it's going to be new fiscal laws and tax laws. We did not expect it to be as complex as it is. It's been difficult.
Give an example of these problems.
I think the best example for me was trying to figure out what a nota fiscal was. So for those of you that don't speak Portuguese, nota fiscal is an official invoice. Now it's so official that, you know, if I was here with Kelly and I was going to sell her 3 bags of coffee for a little roastery, she would get an email from my municipality that we did business, and it's an official registered invoice. So you can't just kind of create an invoice on a piece of paper and send it off like you would in the States, because any invoice that has proper information is valid. Here, no, it's actually an official invoice, and it has to be registered, and then there's oftentimes 3 or 4 different kinds of tax withholdings on the invoice. Sometimes I pay the taxes as the seller, sometimes the buyer pays the taxes. It's so different from how business is done in the States that just getting to understand and how to properly buy and sell coffee took quite a lot. Because you have to put, for example, so if I were to sell coffee to Kelly here, 3 bags of coffee, I would have to put the license plate of the person who is transporting it, their driver's license number, all of their information, as well as all of her information and all of my information on the invoice. It has to be communicated to the state. And so it's a lot of levels of just, you know, I just want to sell 3 bags of coffee, but it's just not that easy.
The government wants to control the tax properly, in an officially way. But this makes life tougher.
It does. I've traveled a lot as a coffee buyer, and a lot of countries are not very good at collecting taxes. And so a lot of times the tax structure doesn't really exist for people to pay proper taxes. In Brazil, it's quite the opposite. They're really good at collecting taxes, and they have all these different stops along the way between your invoices and your staff. It's a very complicated maze, especially for someone who comes in and doesn't speak the language and is kind of learning on the fly.
Let's talk about the farms.
Sure.
Describe them. How big, how many plants, how many cultivars?
So there's 2 farms. Santa Isabel has about 312 hectares of land and about 125 hectares of coffee. If you're listening in English and know acres, that's about maybe 750 acres of land and probably about 300 or 400 acres of coffee. In Brazil, that's a medium-sized farm. There we have about 5 or 6 different cultivars or varieties. So we have yellow bourbon, yellow catuai, red catuai, yellow Icatu. We have a little plot of Obatan, which is another variety as well. It's a mountainous farm, and so the altitude starts at about 1,000 meters and goes up to about 1,200 meters. Basically all mountain farm, and so very little of it is mechanized. So it's not your picture of Brazil where it's flat as a pancake and there's tractors everywhere. It's very mountainous, and we have tractors everywhere.
Because everybody has this image of Brazil, the giant, very rich, full of machinery, but it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, no, and the other farm, Fazenda Monte Verde, has 574 hectares and about 180 hectares of coffee. It's even more mountainous. The level of mechanization there is even lower. The varieties that we have are Yellow Bourbon, Mundo Novo, Acaya, Yellow Catuai, Red Catuai, Icatu as well.
How is the processing in the 2 farms? Are they different or do you take the same thinking?
Process. Yeah. You know, both of the farms have wet mills. On Fazenda Santa Isabel, we have a wet mill that produces 6 different types of coffee. For the kind of the people who have more coffee experience might know that really we strip pick in Brazil. We pick an entire tree at once. And so overripes, ripes, and greens all come in. And on Santa Isabel, we produce 6 different types of coffee out of that. So 2 different kinds of pulp natural, 1 kind of hulled green, the greens, and then 2 different kinds of naturals. On Monte Verde, we do all of that, except we keep the floaters together. And so those floaters become naturals. And so we only have 5 different types of coffee that come off of Monte Verde.
What about the structure? When I visited over there, there was a greenhouse to dry all this. Can you tell me about it? How
sure.
big it is? Why it's important?
So I'm going to have to talk a little bit about the business side. What happens is in Central America, people are used to seeing kind of, you know, large patios and people kind of slowly drying the coffee out on the patio. In Brazil, we have this really amazing harvest season. And so it pretty much doesn't rain from about June until about August. And so you really need to get your harvest done in that time. And so we're not able to kind of have a 5 or 6 month harvest. We really need to kind of squeeze it into those 3 months.
Make it happen.
Make it happen, because that's when the weather is the best. And we have great weather for harvesting coffee. It's dry. It's not too hot during the day. The temperatures aren't too high on the patio. So in order to get it in there, we have to have a fair amount of patio space. We have to have a fair amount of drying capacity. So what we do is we process all the coffee that first day that it's actually picked. And then we spend about 3 days on the patio. So those 3 days on Santa Isabel under a covered patio, on Monte Verde, it's an uncovered patio. And that has to do with really kind of the structure of the farm and how far the staff live away from the patio. Because if you have, you know, 5-10% of your harvest sitting out on the patio and a Saturday afternoon shower comes through, your quality just went from, you know, micro lots to commercial lots, essentially. And so you have to have an incredible amount of careful on the drying of the coffee. And then we have mechanical dryers to finish it. If we were to do everything on the patio, we would have to have these patios that would cover half the farm. It'd be really not very viable.
And how How many dryers do you have then?
On Santa Isabel, we have 6 small dryers, and on Monte Verde, we have 4 larger dryers.
You also keep 2 or 3 experimental gardens where you're cultivating different varietals?
Yes. Yeah, so on Santa Isabel...
Why this concern?
That's a great question. So varieties in coffee, I think they're one of the more important legs of the three-legged stool of creates coffee flavors, I call it, or coffee quality. So you have your variety, you have your processing, and then you have your terroir. So your environment where the coffee's actually grown. The only way to really test what kind of variety is going to pair best with your terroir, because you can't change your altitude, you can't change your soil structure. The only way to really test it is to do the test on your farm. And so on Santa Isabel, we were able to early on plant 3 different variety gardens, each with about 15 of the same varieties in 3 different parts of the farm.
Is there any research or scientists helping you to pair and make the tests?
So what we've done is we've essentially mirrored the variety gardens that are promoted by ProCafe, which is a institution here in Minas that does quite a lot of work. We've done a lot of conversations with variety researchers. However, it's not something that we have necessarily a researcher on staff. It's more of a, we call in some favors for some friends.
Lots of Brazilian producers don't have this position. They believe follow one recipe and that's going to work. But it's not like this.
Well, I think it depends on what your goal is. If your goal is really to produce, you know, exciting, special coffees that you can sell in your cafe in New York, you want to have the absolute maximum potential that your land can offer. In order to kind of capture that maximum potential quality, you need to do those variety tests on your land. While everybody around you might be using Catuai and Mundo Novo, which makes up 90% of the varieties used in Brazil, you might find that a Catucai Topazio tastes really good, but you won't know until you try it. And so that's the premise of us having these variety gardens on Santa Isabel.
Talking about the operation between 2 countries, because I know, I'm aware that the daily basis operation in one farm, it's really complicated, especially when you need to manage lots of employees. Now here, you don't speak Portuguese properly, you're managing 2 farms, and in a daily basis, you're talking to New York.
Well, if there was a picture on this podcast, you'd see that I'm bald. So clearly my hair has suffered. I've actually been bald for a while. It took about 6 months before I was really able to kind of fluently converse in Portuguese, and since then I've been okay with conversing. Having really, the only way to make that work is good people. The only way to make it work is having people that you can trust, people you know that you don't have to say, hey, I need you to be here at 6:30 in the morning because we're doing this and this with the tractor. We have people that don't need that kind of hand-holding. That's really the only way it works. And then just constantly circling back. And so a lot of it is that kind of a very simple system where we make a plan, we try it, and then either before we're done or after we're finished, we have to go back and look, did this work? What can we do better next time? And it's kind of that constant evolution. With New York, it's great because they're very eager to hear about Brazil. They're very eager to hear about how things are going with the harvest, with variety processes, with different processing experiments we've done.
I want to hear your perspective of coffee in Brazil. What was weird when you arrived here?
I always try to think about every coffee country as an island. And so every coffee country, you're going to have to learn how they talk about coffee, the words they use for coffee. And on top of that, there's all that local knowledge that's kind of comes mixed up in it. And some of it doesn't make any sense, and some of it actually makes a lot of sense. One of the things that we worry about in Brazil is frost is a big concern, especially for the coffees at lower altitudes, because it can actually kill the whole tree. And so one of the ways that I was told to kind of relax and calm down on my first harvest here is I was worried about frost. Shortly, I think it was about late July, the farm manager turns to me and says, stop worrying about frost. Look at that tree over there. And I looked over at this tree, and it's an ipé tree, and this tree is covered with beautiful yellow flowers. I mean, it just looks like you can't even see the tree. It's just a big yellow like flower. He says, so you see that? Once the flowers from the ipé open, winter is over and there's no more frost, okay? So just stop sending emails to your boss that you might have a frost damage. And I was like, oh.
You believe it's folklore?
At first I thought it was folklore, and then, you know, after seeing it for 3 or 4 years, and every year seeing that happen again and again and again, even this year when we had frost, once the ipés opened, I was able to sleep better because I knew that the frosts were over. Because it seems a little silly at first, but a lot of that stuff has a lot of truth behind it.
And this kind of information you don't find in books.
You know, those are the conversations that, as we say in English, are on the water cooler. You just kind of, you're looking at from and like kind of just shooting the shit, and that's kind of what comes out.
What kind of advice would you give to someone who lives abroad and wants to invest in farms in Brazil?
To someone who wants to invest in Brazil, be prepared for the bureaucratic side to be a lot more complicated than you may initially expect. I think the whole idea of, you know, we started off with some decent accountants, but we've since changed them because just having the proper support and proper advice from your accountants and from your legal support at the beginning is so important because it is so different and it is so complex. We're funded from a multinational. We want to do everything right and we want to comply, and you need to have that proper counsel.
It's really important to mention this care about doing everything right, because the Guardian newspaper and Brazil reported too some problems related to work and slavery. And I found when I read it, I was curious because I didn't hear lots from the farm or from you, from Fall Cafe.
Yeah.
They described the problem and that's it.
Yeah.
Can you explain, clarify to everybody who has an interrogation mark in their mind?
So this is my first time dealing with negative press. It's been difficult, you know, I think, especially with how we came into this market. You know, we didn't come into this market to try to make a quick dollar and get out. You know, we came in and the first year on Santa Isabel, we planted 200,000 trees. Last year, we planted 200,000 trees in Monte Verde with the hopes of having good harvests in the next 4 years. You know, I think we came in with a long-term mindset. You know, the vision, you know, some of the visionaries for the company have always had that. To have negative press say that, oh yeah, well, you guys weren't paying your pickers right and this and that, and it was, you know, and they completely got all the numbers wrong about how much the settlement was, etc. Kind of slandering the name of Monte Verde and what we're doing here. It was hard to read that.
But what happened, in fact?
And what actually happened was this, is we were following the advice of one of our local accountants about how to manage a payroll mistake, and he gave us some bad advice. And so I followed that advice. The staff got pretty angry about it, took that to the local union, and the local union said, oh, well, look at this. You discounted something out of their payrolls that didn't actually exist. And I said, actually, wait a minute. They all signed a document. Because of an Excel spreadsheet error, they got paid something twice. You know, I had the big meeting with the staff. I explained to everybody, listen, this check's going to be a little bit bigger this week. Next week's going to be a little bit lighter because you all didn't pick this coffee. And everybody says, yes, no problem, until the moment they were discounted. And when that check was discounted, they went running to the union saying, this never really happened. And even with signatures, it didn't matter. According to Brazilian labor law, that was an inappropriate discount. And that caused all kinds of other issues to get drawn into the light. In Brazil, you get paid for a 30-day month while you work, you know, Monday through Friday. You get paid for that Sunday in your payroll. And so that Sunday has to be appropriately calculated based on your production when you're a coffee picker. And the accountant hadn't been calculating that correctly. He had been calculating that as a fixed value, while certain pickers pick a lot of coffee. And so they need to get more on their Sunday. I'm actually grateful that the unions step in and help us negotiate with the staff to have a peaceful, very quick resolve. The discount, I did not know was illegal. The Sunday issue immediately came up and it was immediately resolved. Within 15 days of, or actually within 7 days of negotiating with the union, we settled with the staff immediately. We recognized that we made a mistake and we fixed it. And the fact that this never went to the labor courts, there was no claim, this was not dragged on. As soon as we found the mistake, recognized our error and fixed it, it was resolved. This happens in companies all the time.
And the same workers are with you.
Yeah, a lot of the staff are still with us. You know, there was no intention on our part to take advantage of anybody. And yet, when you read the article and the other articles, because there's actually been about 3 articles using the same source material, it kind of paints a very different picture. Big multinational coming in and, you know, taking advantage of staff. And only after the union came in, we were eventually forced to settle. And it's like, that doesn't capture the spirit at all of what actually happened. And so what really happened was, yes, there was a mistake. We fixed it immediately. And we haven't had any problems since. There are no other union settlements with the staff, because in the process of installing a cost payroll system called Gerente Agricola, so that we would absolutely be airtight on payroll anyway, we actually were in the final stages of that when this came to light. And so we actually used that system to fix all the mistakes. And thankfully, we haven't had any mistakes since. I think the report did not try to put it in context or even kind of capture the spirit behind what was actually going on.
Covering nearly 50% of the South American continent, home to the great Amazon River and the most diverse rainforest on the planet, Brazil is a land teeming with life and energy. Brazil is also a powerhouse coffee producer. 8 billion coffee trees and 8 million people are responsible for contributing a full 33% of the world's supply, and more Arabica than any other origin.
aside controlling the whole process in Brazil, what the group saw here in South America?
Here in Brazil, the whole concept of coffee production is very different. And so when you produce coffee in Costa Rica and Guatemala and Honduras, I visited all of these countries, and really the focus is more on post-harvest management. So once you pick the cherry, do the absolute best you can with that coffee to produce the best quality coffee to get the highest premium you can. But the focus is not really 100% on the production side. And in Brazil, it's quite the opposite. When you see kind of very well organized, very well structured farms, focuses on producing as many bags per hectare as you can. However, once the coffee is picked, that's kind of where Brazil makes a mistake, where they don't, maybe they might strip pick, but then they dry it all together, or there isn't a proper separation of maturation in the post-harvest management. And so what the group saw, and what some of the visionaries who started the whole project saw, was this huge opportunity to be able to produce a lot of coffee per hectare, but also to be able to produce that well. And so that's kind of where we've invested a lot in terms of post-harvest management. So we installed a brand new wet mill on Santa Isabel. We increased the drying capacity, installed that new greenhouse that you saw, the new covered drying patio there, all with the intention of kind of changing that whole paradigm for Brazil. So not just the fact that, oh, you come to Brazil to buy cheap coffee that tastes okay. Our idea is not that at all. Our idea is to produce the absolute best coffee that land can produce, but also produce as much of it as possible, because labor costs here in Brazil are high. Last time I did the calculation, I think between Brazil and Honduras, it's 5 times more expensive labor here than it is in Honduras. And so you've got to produce a lot more coffee in order to kind of cross over that break-even point. And our goal here is not only produce a lot of coffee, but produce a lot of really great coffee.
For a package of sunshine and ravioli, macaroni, if you want the thing you love.
You did it! Congratulations! World's best cup of coffee. Great job, everybody. It's great to meet you. Hi.
A good year for us, yeah. In Cup of Excellence, Fazenda Monte Verde was 19th. It was the only farm in the pulp natural category from Carmo de Minas that made it through. And so we were really excited about that. It was really great, great coffee from this very special part of the farm. And then BSEA, which is the kind of specialty coffee association here in Brazil, they had a competition this year for only their members. And so they opened it up to members only, and Monte Verde won third in the natural competition, and then Santa Isabel won first in the pulp natural competition. And I was really excited about that, because this was a complicated harvest for us. It was, I'm not going to lie, June, 2 weeks of rain, and what was supposed to be the dry season was really tough. But then to be able to pull out those kind of results after that kind of harvest was a pretty huge victory, and I'm pretty proud of that.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. I needed it.
Coffee, 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 coffee.